supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Davies, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. In March, a deadly fire swept through a row house in North Philadelphia, killing four people. City officials say the home was a rooming house, illegally carved into six apartments. In reaction, Licenses and Inspections Commissioner Dave Perry says the city needs to radically rewrite its zoning code to make room for more legal housing. Jake Blumgart of WHYY's Plan Philly has the story.
Commissioner Dave Perry says his agency responds to more than 500 complaints about illegal rooming houses every year. This kind of off-the-books affordable housing can be dangerous, as landlords install wiring without permits and avoid the fire code. But Perry believes these makeshift apartment buildings are here to stay, so we need to legalize them in order to regulate them.
So we have an affordable housing crisis, but yet we have a prohibition against establishing the most inexpensive form of housing in the areas where they're needed the most.
This proposal is more radical than it sounds. Local politicians are most responsive to homeowner groups who fiercely oppose rooming houses. As a result, since the invention of zoning in the 1920s, most cities have outlawed rooming houses. But the Manhattan Institute's Alex Armlovich says they were historically very common.
All the way back to the founding, it's been part of the American housing fabric. When Ben Franklin moved from Philadelphia to Boston as a teenager, his first place of dwelling was a boarding house. And actually, a number of the founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention also stayed in congregate housing in Philadelphia.
These days, Philly mostly only allows rooming houses in neighborhoods that are zoned for the highest density. Most of these places are downtown, where those who need rooming houses the most could never afford to live. That's why Commissioner Perry wants City Council to rewrite the zoning code to allow more legal rooming houses in residential neighborhoods. He says it's the only realistic thing to do in a city where more than 100,000 people live on less than $10,000 a year.
Yeah, I think initially there will be resistance because there's kind of a stigma around rooming houses, but I think we need to start a dialogue. So if it's out there and there's a demand for it, it behooves us to figure out a way of properly regulating it.
Perry hopes to see bills introduced at City Council's fall session. Jake Blumgart, WHYY News.
Activists seeking to boost compensation and management opportunities for women in the workforce are happy about a new pay equity bill in New Jersey. Not so happy about a federal court striking down a Philadelphia ordinance aimed at fighting gender pay discrimination. For a perspective on efforts to help women in the healthcare industry, we welcome Amy Turnquest, president of the Philadelphia chapter of the Healthcare Businesswomen's Association, who recently co-authored a piece on pay equity in the Philadelphia Business Journal. Amy Turnquest, thanks for joining us here on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You say in this piece that New Jersey's new governor signed some new pay equity legislation. What does it do?
What the legislation does is it prevents state agencies in New Jersey from paying men and women different salaries for roles or positions at equal levels.
Doesn't affect private employers?
It does not.
Okay. And what's happening on this side of the Delaware River in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania?
On this side of the Delaware River, we've had legislation that was passed last January trying to add equality, pay equality here in Philadelphia that would be beyond just the state organizations here in Philly. That legislation has been stalled really due to an inability to gain agreement on what's the best way to impact gender pay equity here in Philadelphia. So there's some debate for businesses as to whether or not this specific piece of legislation is healthy for women as well as for business.
This is the legislation that prevents employers from asking about past salaries?
It is.
Right. And was recently struck down by a federal judge.
It was.
How does that work? I mean, how does that affect pay equity to ask about previous compensation?
One of the things that we know about pay equity for women is that women tend to enter the workforce at a lower starting salary, and then they tend to get promoted at a slower rate. Sometimes women also are taking time out of the workforce to raise families. And when you compound all of that over time, it can compound the effect and mean that women are earning less income over time for doing similar work. So the theory is by asking someone to tell you what they've achieved in the past, that could impact or bias your decision about what their worth is today when they're undertaking a new position.
And you're saying it's not clear from both sides whether this is effective approach?
Right. Legislation right now is highly contested and debated as to whether or not this is effective. That's why we're advocating for some other solutions, some that could be voluntary or more education and skill development based. What seems to be agreed upon from everyone on all sides of the aisle is that there is a gender pay gap, that it's important for us to close it, and that there are benefits to businesses, men as well as women, and the organizations that employ them when they have a higher degree of women in leadership roles.
So how does the Healthcare Business Women's Association try and get at this issue apart from advocating legislation?
Our vision is to be a united force for change and bringing men and women together to solve this problem, to bring business and industry and the private and public sectors together to find the best practice for solving this problem. So we are doing several things within HBA, several things that we do empower individual women to get them to advocate more strongly for themselves and get skills and development. Some of the things we do actually are working with our corporate partners and companies to get their input on helping empower and raise the awareness and the discussion within their organizations.
You mentioned getting women to advocate for themselves.
Yes.
Why?
Women generally have not been as assertive as men when they're getting that first job or advocating for pay raises over time. Also, even advocating for our own worth when we're trying to get internal promotions, aggressively seeking out mentors and sponsors within the workforce are all areas where we believe women can play a more active role. So a lot of the programming that we have within HBA is designed to help provide those tools.
Do you see progress in the time you've been doing this?
I do and I don't. I was asked earlier if I was surprised that we were still having these conversations. And the topic around that was that, yes, I'm surprised, but then, okay, I guess maybe we're not so surprised in terms of how long it really takes to make cultural changes like this. We're seeing, though, signs where organizations are stepping up all just in the last year, right? So Amazon in January of 2017 said voluntarily that they'll no longer ask women what their past salary history is, and they did that voluntarily. Mark Benioff at Salesforce, he tells a story about how he looked around a room and he noticed that there were only men at the table. And he created his own rule that said that he wasn't going to be in any more meetings that didn't have 30% women in those meetings. So those are some examples of some really thoughtful and considered approaches that we're seeing where executives are standing up. And we didn't see that 5 years ago.
Have you personally experienced gender discrimination at work?
I have.
Can you tell me about it?
Sure. Earlier in my career, when I was a younger manager, I had made the decision to have children. And my goal was, really, I wanted it all, right? I wanted my career, I wanted my family, and I was really committed to doing that. My boss, who was a woman at the time, made it very clear to me that anything that was happening in my personal life was not to be brought into work, that people at work didn't want to hear about my children. I was threatened to be fired at one point because I had to take 2 days off in a row when I had a sick child. And generally, those conversations, I don't believe, would have happened with my male counterparts.
Right. And in this case, the fact that it was a woman tells us what about how pervasive this stuff is?
It's not always men, right? So the propagation here is not always coming from one side of the aisle. And again, that's why we need to bring men and women together to fix the problem.
Amy Turnquist, thanks so much for speaking with us on Newsworks today.
Thank you.
Last fall, WHYY chronicled the story of a growing former agricultural town in Delaware that rallied around its high school football team, seeking its third straight state title. While reporting that story, we were drawn to the tale of the humble young man at the center of the team's stunning success. From the Delaware desk, WHYY's Chris Barish tells the story of what he's overcome.
When Will Knight talks about football, the conversation doesn't revolve around himself.
Football, it's a great sport. You get to come out and prepare with your team and just grind it out and have a build a relationship with different people.
Over the last four autumns, Smyrna High football fans forged a special bond with Knight. He was the player who ran, fought, and led their beloved Eagles and himself into the Delaware sports history books. Listen to Mike Judy, Smyrna's head coach, talk about a special player.
He's a once-in-a-career guy. You know, he's the perfect package of athleticism, work ethic, great character. He's great in the classroom. He's been an amazing asset to us, and just really, I'm really thankful I got a chance to coach him.
Thankful indeed. The speedy, muscular halfback scored 119 touchdowns. That's nearly three a game, an all-time Delaware record. He also lifted Smyrna, which had never been even a football contender, to three straight Division I championships.
And welcome, head coach Mike Dewey and the 2017
Winning such lofty honors would lead many kids to carry themselves with a serious swagger. Yet listen tonight after his final triumphant game.
I'm honored to be able to play for Smyrna High School football and to be able to play with the teammates. They changed my life and my mindset. They taught me how to never be satisfied with failure and just strive at everything with the best you can.
That's what Will Knight has always done. Fate has haunted and continues to haunt him and his family. But Knight has worked tirelessly to overcome hardship and heartbreak and be a good son, brother, student, teammate. Through it all, his modesty has become legendary. Social studies teacher Whitney Reed, who coaches the cheerleading squad, raved about Knight before one game.
He's just awesome.
He doesn't play the football star in class?
Doesn't play the football star at all. He's very uncomfortable. When you make him the center of attention, out here it's a different story. In the classroom, at school, he's just Will.
So what makes Will Knight run? It starts at home, where Knight, the third of five children, was raised by his mother Yolanda, who struggled to provide for the family. But Yolanda showed her children how to prevail. The single mom earned a college degree and moved her family out of public housing. She got help from Habitat for Humanity. And Will said she was always there to cheer him on.
I look up to her, and I'm proud of her because of how strong she is. She's very supportive. She worked countless hours of just nonstop working and making sure that we're okay and have everything that we need.
Before Knight's final high school game, Yolanda said she didn't anticipate her son's success.
Him and his other brothers used to go out on the field in the backyard of our home, and they used to just throw the ball around, but I just never thought it would grow to be such a big surprise like this.
On the gridiron, Knight battled several injuries this season, but he always rebounded to carry the load. In the season grand finale in December against rival Middletown, he scored three TDs and passed for another as the Eagles completed their third championship season. Knight received several scholarship offers. He initially committed to the University of Delaware, but ultimately chose Old Dominion in Norfolk, Virginia. He hopes to major in physical therapy. He announced his choice on December 20th in the Smyrna gym, surrounded by his family, including 22-year-old brother Wade, a former Smyrna athlete who owned a moving company.
This is mainly for my mom, so she wouldn't have to pay for college. So it's for you, Mom.
Yet that day ended in tears. About 8:30 p.m., Wade Knight was speeding on a back road near Smyrna when he lost control of his car and struck several trees. Wade was pronounced dead at the scene. Coach Judy said Wade's death was devastating.
That day it's not a day we'll ever forget. It's the ultimate swing in emotions. We're happy for him, and you know, we have the celebration, and then, you know, for tragedy to strike like that, it was rough break.
The Smyrna community rallied around the Knights, helping raise money for Wade's funeral. When WHYY interviewed Knight at school in late March, we agreed not to ask about his brother's death. His mother and school administrators said it would be too painful. But Knight, who wears a medallion with his beaming brother's photo, brought up Wade, who was known as Boo Boo, while showing us his tattoos, including one dedicated to his big brother.
And it's two stars, and then I got two goals. So his goal was to make his moving business a multi-billionaire business. So my goal was to get to the NFL. So it's two stars and one reaching out to always remind me that he'll always be with me.
If Knight doesn't make it in the pros, he hopes to work in a sports-related field. But no matter what, the humble superstar will keep running, striving to reach the end zone. Chris Barish, WHYY News.
Attitudes about our readiness to retire vary, often by how close we are to confronting the reality of life after work. Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, joined NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller to discuss Americans' concerns about their twilight years.
Frank, when does worry about retirement tend to peak?
Dave, it tends to peak in the mid-age years when people start to think about retirement. Interestingly, young people, and maybe this isn't really surprising, are much less likely to say they worry about having enough money to live comfortably when they retire than those who are actually getting close to retirement age. But I should point out that overall, it's still not a lot of Americans who say, oh yeah, no problem with retirement. That's at 51% now who projecting, and these are people who are not retired, 51% of people not retired project and say they'll have enough money to live comfortably. You do the math, that leaves about half of Americans who are worried, saying, looking ahead, I'm not sure I'll have enough money to live comfortably. And I should say, when we go back prior to the recession, 2002, 2003, in those years, it was closer to 60% who said they would be able to live comfortably. So we have not yet recovered from where we were prior to the recession. And a lot of Americans out there, a lot of workers, those who are not yet in their 60s and 70s, are worried about what's going to happen when they do retire.
On the face of it, it sounds like the public is ignoring the advice of investors to not wait till that age to begin to think about retirement.
That's right. Obviously, Americans who are younger are less worried, but that could be because they're optimistic, right? Maybe they are thinking about it carefully, and they say, oh, we'll have a wonderful Social Security system, and I'm investing in all that.
Well, let's look at the Social Security system. What percent of potential retirees think that will be their major source of income?
This is a critical point, Dave. That percent is only 30%. Who think that Social Security will be a major source of income when they retire, and that's considerably below the percent, which is about half, who say that a 401 or IRA plan will be what they are going to rely on when they retire. And the reason I say this is a critical point is because we also interview current retirees. And among those now retired, 57% say that Social Security actually is a major source of income, and that's far ahead of any other source of income for people who are now retired. So there's a discrepancy here. Americans don't think they're going to rely on Social Security, but once people retire, they do rely on it. So we really have to put those two together and figure out what's going to happen in the future. If Social Security collapses, Americans are really going to be in trouble, it looks like to us.
And on average, retire at what age?
Well, Americans who are now retired actually retired at age 61, which is pretty young. Now, that includes, of course, Americans we interview up in their 70s and 80s. And perhaps when they did retire, 61 was a more reasonable age. But when we ask Americans who are not retired when they are going to retire, they're now saying 66. And I should say, a few decades before now, previous to now, when we asked the same questions, Americans were projecting they were going to retire at a younger age. So Americans' projected age of retirement is going up now from where it was. And clearly, Americans think they're going to be working a lot longer than people who are currently retired actually work.
Does the public prioritize spending or saving?
I think it is a norm in American culture to say, I'm the type of person who likes saving. We've asked this question over the years. We actually started asking it because we thought there may be major differences between men and women. The question being, are you the type of person who likes saving, or are you the type of person who enjoys spending more? Actually, there haven't been very many differences by gender on that. And what we have discovered is particularly, I keep coming back to it, since those pivotal years of the recession, we have many, many more Americans who say psychologically, cognitively, they enjoy saving. It's about 59% of Americans right now who, given that choice, say, oh, I'm the type of person who likes to save, leaving just 40% who say, I'm the type of person who likes to spend.
When it actually comes to savings, what form of investment do they lean toward?
Real estate. We give Americans a series of investments and say which one is the best long-term investment, and 34% come back and tell us it's real estate. 26% say stocks, 17% gold, 15% CDs, and just 6% say bonds. So at this point, if you want the collective wisdom of the people, Dave, put all of your millions in real estate.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight.
You've heard of hot yoga, power yoga, restorative yoga? How about laughter yoga? This Sunday in Fairmount Park, the goofiest of yogas is holding Philadelphia's first official celebration of World Laughter Day. WHYY's Liz Tung got a preview at a laughter yoga class in Media.
It's a Monday evening, and in a community center in Media, half a dozen people are tossing around a beach ball. This is the start of the weekly laughter yoga class led by instructor Alexa Drew Bay, who's organizing this year's World Laughter Day event. Alexa says laughter yoga isn't like the yoga most people know. There's no stretching or poses.
Laughter yoga is just a series of laughter exercises that were developed by a medical doctor in India. And the yoga part of laughter yoga is the yogic breathing.
Exercises include talking in gibberish, singing, dancing. They even play with a parachute. And of course, they laugh. Laughter yoga was invented in the mid-90s, and proponents say it can improve blood pressure, lower stress, boost the immune system. And that's true even if your laughter isn't real.
You may not really feel like laughing, but this is laughter exercise. It's really important to remember it's exercise. And the thing is, when you're laughing and you're even initially faking it, it can still benefit.
Science backs that up. University of Auckland researcher Michaela Law recently led a study on the cardiovascular benefits of fake and real laughter.
In our study, we actually found that fake laughter caused a greater exercise effect. So by that, I mean a greater increase in heart rate and decrease in heart rate variability. And these are the similar effects that we see when people exercise.
That makes laughter yoga good for people who are older or have disabilities that make regular exercise hard. And then there are the benefits for mental health. Jackie Hines, who helped lead the class this day, has been doing laughter yoga for more than a year.
Oh, I am so much more calm than I used to be. I was very much type A, very stressed out. I worked in IT for many years. I would just, you know, feel myself just my blood pressure rising, you know, when things would not necessarily work out. And now I just take a beat and I laugh.
Liz Tung, WHYY News.
And that's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Davies for NewsWorks Tonight.